This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Dan Band performing some swing. Once in a Boo Moon is on Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church from 7 to 10 p.m. Doors open at 6 p.m., so plan on arriving early, as ticket prices also include desserts with coffee or tea. There will also be a silent auction and raffle items to view. For full details, go to the KBOO website at kboo.fm and click on Once in a Boo Moon under Coming Events. All proceeds...
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's time for Veterans Voice, coming right up in a few moments. Hosts Bill and Marvin are going to interview Nick Terse, the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features excerpts from Roadmap to Apartheid. It's a new film on Israel's policies and actions against Palestine. Also, the weekly report on occupied Palestine with Nora Barrows-Friedman and the Electronic Intifada. At 11 o'clock on the Radio Zine, filmmaker and clinical psychologist Jan Hawken discusses her film Mind Zone, Therapists Behind the Front Lines, which launches Rethinking Psychiatry's annual film festival on February 21st. And at 11:30, we speak with organizer and teacher Scott Silber about corporate personhood and his talk this weekend in Portland called Threat to Themselves and Others, Intervention on the Corporate Addiction to Power. And thank you, KBOO members, for your great support. If you're not a member, you can become one very easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And with no more further ado, here comes Veterans Voice.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, or on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. I'm Marvin, along with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
Today, our guest is Nick Terse, and Nick is the author of Killing Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Nick is the managing editor of TomDispatch.com and the author of The Complex, How the Military Invades Our Everyday Lives. And he's also on a lot of other programs too. A lot of books, a lot of appearances on radio. He's got the Written Hour Prize for writing on when he wrote the articles about the horrible crimes in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam in 68 and 69. And it's a very good articles. I hope as we go along talking with Nick that folks will go and look at those articles that he's written. And we'd like to start and welcome you, Nick, to Veterans Voice Radio Show.
Well, thanks very much for having me on today.
Oh, it's our pleasure. It's our pleasure. I got the book. I was told about the book, and then I got the book, and I read it. And in it, it just hit home with me. I mean, I was in Vietnam in 1968 and part of 69, and everything in here to me rang true. I mean, nothing in here didn't sound true, because I was with the kind of guys that did those things. And Bill was in Korea, but Bill was in you were a truck driver.
Yeah, I was in the engineer battalion.
Engineer battalion. So, Nick, I want to start with asking you a couple questions here, and I'd like to know for our listeners to how you got involved in the stuff on Vietnam, of all things.
Yeah, this was something that I really stumbled into. I was a graduate student at the time, and I was working on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam vets. And basically, I would travel down to the National Archives on a regular basis, and I'd try and find records to match up with the self-report material that we had, basically what veterans told us about their service. Then I would go down there and try and find records to corroborate what they had said. And I was down there on one research trip, and I'd spent about 2 weeks, and every research avenue that I tried was a dead end. I just ran into brick wall after brick wall, and finally, on my last day there, I went to an archivist, and I said to him, you know, look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed, or I'm never going to get back down here. So you got to give me something, at least a lead to bring back. And, you know, he thought about it for a moment, and then he said a couple words that really changed my life. He said to me, do you think that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress? And I told him, I thought it was an excellent hypothesis. You know, what do you have on war crimes?
Mm-hmm.
And he said that there were records sitting in the archives basement for something called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. And, but no one had really looked at them. They'd been sitting down there about 7 years. And I said, you know, why don't you pull those records from me? And he did. And within an hour, I was paging through these files. And, to call it a treasure trove of information is the wrong phrase. I mean, this was a horror trove. We're talking about reports of massacres, murder, torture, assault, mutilation. It was a horrific record, and I knew that most of these cases weren't in the literature anywhere. And that's what really started me out on this. This was what led me to writing Kill Anything That Moves.
Yeah, the working group that you're talking about, it was made by who?
This was run out of the Pentagon. It was General William Westmoreland, who, I'm not sure if all your listeners will remember, but he was the supreme American commander in Vietnam, and then by this time he had been promoted up to Army Chief of Staff.
Mm-hmm.
And he put together this working group. It was basically a group of colonels with one brigadier general over them, and they were tasked basically with making sure that the Army was never caught flat-footed again by an atrocity scandal, as happened at after My Lai,
mm-hmm.
to the My Lai exposure. So these colonels tracked all the reports that were coming up. They created briefing reports for top Pentagon brass, Secretary of Defense, even the White House. And whenever they could, they tamped down allegations to make sure that these crimes didn't become public.
Yeah, one of the interesting things in your book you talk about, and that is the My Lai. My Lai was March 16th, I think, 1968, and they killed over 504 innocent civilians. In your book, you say that wasn't the first one. that there were definitely massacres before that by the Marines. Do you know what was your first one that you found before My Lai?
You know, it's a good question. You know, I catalog a number of massacres in the book that occur in 1967.
67, wow.
Yeah, but I'm not sure exactly which one is the first. I begin the book with a 1967 massacre by Marines in Quan Tri, in a little village called True Eye, and you know, so this is several months prior to My Lai, and I found this the record of this massacre in a court-martial record, not in the war crimes working group documents. I mined a lot of different sources for this. And then I went to Vietnam to track down witnesses and survivors so I could try and tell the story by interweaving the American accounts and the Vietnamese to give as full a picture as I could.
And who did you interview? How did you get to the village in Vietnam? I mean, did you have an American go with there, or did you have a Vietnamese interpreter?
Yeah, I had a Vietnamese fixer, a translator who worked with me. I went to Vietnam a total of four times during this project, and I was lucky to work with one translator for two of the trips and two of the longest of those trips, and. He was a country boy, so he had a very good rapport with people out in rural areas. Basically, I was often the first American to visit these villages since the war.
Mm-hmm.
We were fairly far out in the countryside, and perhaps the first unarmed Westerner to ever come to these villages. They'd only ever known
probably
French
true
or
yeah.
Americans, and. So I was lucky to have a translator who really had a good rapport with people.
Okay, tell us what happened there at that village.
Well, this particular village, it follows the chain of events is a very common one. The Marines were they'd been out in the field for several days, and they came to the outskirts of this village. In the evening, it was just after dark, and one of the Marines tripped a booby trap, which killed him and injured two or three other Marines there. So, they hunkered down and waited for a medevac chopper to come in and take out the dead and the wounded. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you. I mean, this is a very common story. Then you have these. American Marines who were angry and frustrated. There's no enemy to lash out at, and there's their officer there. He was he called together the squad leaders, and he said to the leader of the squad that had lost a man. He said, yours is going to be the first squad through. This is the village that caused this. They're responsible. And he said, I want you to go through, and, when it comes to children, let your conscience be your guide. But otherwise, he was telling them to go in and wipe out the village.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the Marines said that the order that was passed along to him was to kill anything that moves. This phrase that eventually became the title of my book. And, the Marines went through there. In this village, it happened to be... one that had been cleared out by another Marine patrol a couple days before. They had burned the village to the ground, and they'd sent the villagers away. The villagers got to their refugee point, but they got there, of course, with none of their possessions. So they asked to go back, and they were allowed, the women and children and elderly men, no military-age males were allowed. But the rest were allowed to go back and gather up their things. So that's who was there that night when the Marines came through for their revenge patrol. It was women and children who'd been sent back to scavenge for whatever hadn't been burned.
So what do you think started the killings? What do you think? I know what happens because I was in that position before, but tell our listeners, what these Marines told you about what started them off. I mean, you know, that when they went back to the village, why the decision was made to start killing these civilians?
Well, I mean, these guys were really angry, and they were primed to lash out. They'd been given an order by their commander. And, you know, they got into the village, and they couldn't see anyone, but they heard voices, and they heard people shuffling around in the bunkers beneath their feet. You know, all the homes basically had been burned, but there were the Vietnamese, they were bomb shelters, but to these Marines, they were considered enemy bunkers that could house guerrillas. So, you know, one of the lieutenants there instructed his Marines to grenade the bunkers, and they did. And once the grenades went off, people came rushing out, and, you know, the Marines said that what they saw were just, you know, flashes of people running out. So they were given an order to open up, and they did on full automatic with their M16s and gunned down people as they were running out of the bunkers. Then there was, you know, another Marine, a Lance Corporal, who just decided to take a woman that he found, and he marched her out into a rice paddy and just, you know, shot her in cold blood. You know, but he had received this order from his commander. And, you know, he said that he thought it was a legitimate order, and he was doing what he was told. You know, he was a good Marine, and that's what Marines do.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the end of this, there were 12 Marine civilians who were dead. Two were gunned down in cold blood, that woman and then an elderly man who was just shot point blank. But and the rest, there were survivors of this, children who came out of the bunkers and weren't gunned down, and they were just pushed across a river and left there. And the others were just eventually called in as enemy killed in action.
Body count.
Yeah. And that was the story of this massacre.
It was just horrible. It's horrible. You know, people have heard of My Lai, and you know, things like that. But the one thing that in your book, that I thought was really, really interesting, in the book "Kill Anything That Moves: The Real American War in Vietnam," the one thing you talk about that I'd never heard anybody else talk about was the road kills. I'd seen it in Vietnam, but I'd never read it in a book. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, I tried to, you know, take a sweep as I could of the different forms of brutality that that were committed against the Vietnamese. And one thing that I heard from veterans, and I would see, you know, a fleeting reference to it in literature, and when I talked to Vietnamese, something that came up was the fact that the Americans would drive through the country at extreme speeds in these large convoys, and that even with all the other brutality that went on during the war, Vietnamese would key in on this because to them it seemed very egregious, and it seemed you know, maybe the most profligate type of killing, because Americans would reach down and grab a girl as she was riding on a bicycle and cause her to fall underneath the tracks of a tank or a deuce and a half, a 2.5-ton truck. They would throw, you know, heavy sea ration cans at little kids as hard as they could and try and hit them with it. They would just run Vietnamese off the road or knock over the Lambrettas, the little three-wheeled scooters that the Vietnamese used. And this was something that it seemed to come up again and again, and I noticed that when the RAND think tank would do surveys of Vietnamese, this was something that the Vietnamese really keyed in on. They felt that the Americans could do anything in the country, and this was something that was totally inexcusable. It wasn't even, to them, part of the war. It was just a way that Americans, you know, displayed their dominance and showed that they could do anything in Vietnam and get away with it.
Yeah, it seemed like as the war went on that less and less the Americans' troops looked at the Vietnamese as being human beings. They looked at them as, you know, animals, or you know, just aliens from another world. I remember talking to guys, Nick, who had no sympathy or empathy for the Vietnamese people. They thought they were less than humans. And you came up what you'd found was called the mere gook rule. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, this is again a shorthand MGR. I would see and hear that from guys, from veterans, and you know, it stood for the mere gook rule. And the idea was that the Vietnamese weren't real people; they were subhuman, mere gooks who could be abused or even killed at will. You know, I talked to you know, a lot of veterans who told me that they remembered as soon as they got to boot camp, they were told, don't call them Vietnamese. Call them gooks or dinks, slants, slopes, anything to dehumanize them, to take away the humanity of the Vietnamese and make it easier to kill them, basically. And it was something that came up again and again. You know, I interviewed you know, somewhere between 100 and 200 veterans for this book, and it was something that really, you know, stood out to me that I kept hearing again and again.
You know, Man, that is. I think they do it in every war. I know. I'm pretty sure Korea did it, didn't they, Bill?
Oh, that's. I think that's where the term originated. Was Miguk was commonly used to refer to the Korean natives.
Yeah. So that has happened. I'm pretty sure in every war, the Vietnamese people in those villages were horrified, Nick, when we had come into a village. They were horrified of us. Coming into the village, here we were, these kids in just full armor with guns. We could do anything we wanted. We were well-fed, well-armed, you know, and they were afraid of us. They were definitely afraid of us. And one of the things that you talk about in your book was we've mentioned before a little bit in some of our shows on KBOO was about rape. And rape happened a lot in Vietnam, and you talk about this in your book, and I'm glad you did talk about it, because it's just a horrid story about what happened to the women in Vietnam. Could you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, you know, this is you know, it's another component of warfare, is sexualized type of warfare, and you know, of course, like all war crimes, you know, cover-ups make it impossible for us to know what the extent was, but you know, the record that I examined and the anecdotal reports seem to point to, you know, pervasive use of rape as a weapon of war in the countryside. And the records that I did find pointed to a you know, an exceptionally savage form of sexual crimes in a lot of cases. Often I felt that I really didn't have the language to describe it, because just to call some of these incidents a gang rape didn't seem like it was adequate to the task. Mm-hmm. You know, I go through one particular incident in the book in some detail from court-martial records. There were two Vietnamese girls, teenagers, who were captured, and you know, I'm not sure that there was really any good evidence of it, but they were considered VC nurses, but instead of being shuttled into, you know, the camp for prisoners, they were brought to the area where the troops that had detained them were staying for the night, and word spread that they'd be raped, and you know, this came to pass, and the testimony of the perpetrator shows that you know, they guessed amongst themselves that these girls were raped between 10 and 20 times each over the course of a night. And, you know, afterwards in the morning, they were found to be, you know, bleeding and in, you know, just dire straits. And then one of the Americans on the scene had another Vietnamese prisoner come over and at gunpoint shoot one of the girls. And she wasn't killed by the shot, and eventually she was executed by an American. And the other girl, she was examined by a medic and found to be in extremely poor condition, and the records kind of lost track of what happened to her. She mm-hmm. was said to have just disappeared or gone home, so mm-hmm. we can guess what became
yeah.
of her.
Yeah.
But, you know, these were extremely savage crimes, and I think they happened a lot more than people have had any awareness of.
I think you're right. In fact, I know you're right. One of the things, too, that you talk about in the book is the mutilations, that mutilations got to be, when you think of the Vietnamese as not being a people, being less than a human being, it's pretty easy to mutilate them. And you talked about that. Could you talk about it a little more?
Yeah, you know, I found in the records a lot of accounts of mutilation. In some cases, this was tied to the idea of a body count. You had to show evidence of enemy dead, and one way to do it was to bring back ears. Ears also became something of a currency in some units. These would be, you know, taken from the dead, either dead enemies or dead civilians, and then brought back to base camps where they might be traded for beers or sold for money. There's even an account that I go over in the book where the unit was beheading enemies, then they were boiling the flesh off the skulls, and the skulls were traded for radios and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I found records of units where it wasn't uncommon for men to have an ear or two on a necklace, or maybe an entire an entire necklace full of ears. There was fingers being kept, genitals, scalps, noses. This was, it was gruesome. And again, I think this is it's something that really hasn't been talked about a lot in the literature. When it has, it hasn't, it's been portrayed, I think, as a relatively isolated type of activity. But the records I found seem to indicate otherwise.
Yeah,
went on a lot of units across Vietnam.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Bill, did you have something you wanted to ask you?
Yes, I wanted to ask you, Nick. You refer to court records or court martial records, and is this information, does it come from the perpetrators or from the questioners or persecutors or prosecutors?
Well, depending on the records, most of the thorough investigations that were carried out, there's sworn testimony from witnesses. There's also testimony from perpetrators. In some cases, they fully admit to committing atrocities, and others, of course, they're more reticent, or they won't talk to investigators. And then there's also court martial transcripts where you have generally both the perpetrators or the alleged perpetrators and other witnesses who are, almost all the time fellow GIs.
Uh-huh.
When you were talking to these, we're going to get to talking about Jamie Henry in just a little bit.
Okay.
But some of these, when you found their names, the guys' names in these files from the archives, and you went to visit them, how were you received?
Well, it really was, the responses were across the spectrum, as you might imagine. There were, sometimes I'd call and I'd be hung up on immediately, and sometimes I could talk my way into having someone, speak to me for several hours. Sometimes I'd just show up on a door and knock on it cold, and once in a while I'd get a door slammed in my face, but generally, these guys would be willing to talk at least a little bit. Sometimes I found myself talking through, the door open a crack, but standing there for an hour or more talking to someone through a partially open door. Generally, I found that if I displayed some knowledge of the war, that I had a good grasp of the terminology, and I knew where they'd served, I knew their unit. They were willing to at least entertain my questions, and I was surprised on many occasions. There were many men that I thought, I knew what they had they'd confessed to, or I knew what their fellow unit members said they'd done, and I didn't think there was any chance that they would talk to me.
But in
many cases they did. They opened up and they told me things I didn't imagine they'd be willing to.
Because they felt that they weren't going to get any in trouble, because no one got any in trouble, before, and the war was over and there was nothing to worry about.
Nick, did any of them show any signs of remorse?
Yeah.
Yeah, I I did run into veterans who are very remorseful. There's one veteran I think I mentioned him briefly in the book, but you know what he really stuck with me. He was telling me about we talked for several hours about his experience in Vietnam, and I knew from the records his unit had participated in various forms of brutality, but nothing specifically mentioned him. And he was very jovial, and he had an infectious laugh, and we were talking for a while, but then he got quiet, and he told me about one particular GI in his unit. And this one day, they were going to a village, they were burning it down, and an old lady came up, and she grabbed him on the arm and was yelling at him, of course, because her home was being burned down. And he said that this GI pushed her off and then took the butt of his rifle and hit her squarely in the face and broke her nose. There was blood everywhere, and she was screaming. And he said that this GI just turned around and walked away laughing. And then a couple minutes later, he said, when I told you that, that soldier was me. And, I really had a tough time connecting up the man that I was talking to his 19-year-old self. And he told me that he had a very hard time, doing the same, that he couldn't believe that he had done that, that he couldn't believe that he'd done, other things, perhaps worse in Vietnam. But he said, at the time, he didn't think anything of it. But in the years since, he couldn't get it out of his head.
Right.
And that, it was something that had, been a burden for him his entire life after Vietnam. So yeah. this one incident when he was, barely out of boyhood had stuck with him, and it really was troubling to him.
Yeah. We're going to take just a little bit break.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, or on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. I'm Marvin, along with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
Today, our guest is Nick Turse, and Nick is the author of Killing Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Nick is the managing editor of TomDispatch.com and the author of The Complex, How the Military Invades Our Everyday Lives. And he's also...
Okay, a little bit of a technical problem here. We're going to listen to a little music and then start the second half of the interview. Thanks for hanging on there.
He's 5 foot 2 and he's 6 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist.
You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And we're talking to Nick Turse, who's written Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. And Nick has done a really great, great book here. And I'm really hoping that more people will read the book and really learn what the Vietnam War was about. It was basically a war on the Vietnamese people, and when I talk about people, I mean civilians. Somewhere early in the war, they knew that they weren't going to do very good, and so they went after the civilian population, thinking that if they really put violence on the people, that maybe that would force the civilians to go after the Viet Cong and quit helping the Viet Cong. And they sure put the pressure. Nick, one of the things that's really interesting when you talk about what happened was that we were supposedly at war with the National Liberation Front and the NVA, but we sure bombed the South more than we ever bombed the North with the B-52s.
Really the South that bore the brunt of all U.S. firepower, and it's I think a lot of people don't quite understand that it was the South, America's ally, that was really pummeled by all this firepower, and the people that, you know, the Americans were supposedly, you know, protecting from outside of aggression, who really suffered from, you know, the U.S. unleashing all these bombs and artillery shells and helicopter gunships on the rural areas.
Yeah, just a basic attack on anybody that moved. Like you said, kill anything that moves, and that's what we did in the war. And something else interesting that in 1968, the year I was there, you know, 16,592 Americans were killed. But you can just four, five, six times as many civilians were killed, Nick, at that time in 1968. So the whole, you know, they're saying, what, 3 million Vietnamese died during the war? I'm thinking it's probably more, don't you?
Well, you know, the Harvard Medical School researchers and the University of Washington, they did some real intricate demographic research and came up with a number of 3.8 million violent war deaths. And I think it's the highest estimate that we have, you know, that they've come up with over the years, different researchers who've looked at this. But I think it might still be on the low side.
I do too.
You know, even with the numbers that we have, I mean, the best estimates we have indicate that, you know, at least 2 million civilians died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, add to that 5.3 million civilian wounded, using a very conservative method of estimating. Around 11 million Vietnamese were made refugees during the war. This is from the U.S. Government's own estimates. And as many as 4 million Vietnamese exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange.
Yes.
So it's suffering on an almost unimaginable scale.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, because I go back, Nick, the first time I went back was in 1994, and I go back every year, maybe year and a half, I go back. And I you can still see the Agent Orange that just ravaged that country, just ravaged it, and the illnesses. And those people are definitely got to be added into the people who got, you know, who died from the war is from Agent Orange, and it's just so horrible. I want to talk to you a little bit now, Nick, about some of the things in your book, Le Bac Massacre. Could you please talk about that one?
Sure. You know, when I went to investigate this massacre, you know, it's one that it will forever be seared into my mind. And I mention it briefly in Kill Anything That Moves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was I had read about the massacre in this tiny hamlet, and I traveled there to find a survivor who was mentioned in the documents that I had. And after some searching, I located this woman, and she'd been a young girl when the Marines had marched into her hamlet. And she was hiding in a bomb shelter with her grandmother and an elderly neighbor. And, you know, after the shelling had stopped, they had run there because the American artillery had begun shelling the hamlet. So once the shelling stopped, they ran out of the bunker because they didn't want to be in there when the Marines came in and started throwing grenades into the bunker. And as they did, you know, she told me that there was a Marine who was standing there, and he, you know, he turned towards them, he leveled his rifle, and he shot you know, the elderly neighbor, and shot her grandmother. And both old women dropped right there, and she told me that she just wheeled around and ran back into the bunker. And the Marines threw grenades in there, but the bunker had angled walls, so it saved her from the blast. And when she emerged from the bunker, she said there were a total of 15 people in the village who'd been killed in a massacre.
Mm.
And I interviewed other people who lived in the hamlet, and they all had the same number. They said 15 had been killed there.
Jeez, that just seems like the area you were in Quang Nai, Quang Nam province, you could have probably gone to just about any village there, and something would have happened during that time, Nick, you know, with the Americans going in there. So who the operation at the one, I want to talk to you now about one, but first, before we go into, it's from the 9th Division down in the Mekong Delta, but Let's talk about Jamie Henry, which plays an important part in this. Could you tell how you found his name and about him, about Jamie?
Sure. You know, Jamie Henry really affected my life, and I found him in that original batch of records in the National Archives in the War Crimes Working Group files. And he had made allegations that the Army investigated, and they did a very thorough job. So it was a very detailed case file that I had to go by. And you know, as I went over this, I realized that I really wanted to meet Jamie and talk to him, and I eventually did. And you know, Jamie was he was a self-described hippie living in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district before the war. But he was drafted and he became a medic, and by all accounts, he was a very good one. He saved a lot of American lives, and the men who served with him, they said he was a fantastic medic, and they also said he was fearless. He was the only medic they ever saw who would actually walk point, be the lead man in the patrol. So, you know, so Jamie was he became a very good soldier, but he was shocked by what he saw in Vietnam. He told me that on his first day in the field, he watched the point man, the lead man of his patrol that day, detain a young girl and molest her right there on the trail. And he thought to himself, you know, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing months, he watched a litany of atrocities take place. He saw a young boy who was executed for no reason, an old man who was used for target practice, a prisoner who was thrown off a cliff, a man who was held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier, basically a small tank. And when he spoke up about brutality, his life was threatened by other members of the unit. And even his friends told him, you know, look, you better keep your mouth shut or you're going to get a bullet in the back during a firefight and nobody's going to be the wiser. So Jamie did keep his mouth shut, but he kept his eyes open and he kept cataloging everything that he saw. And this really culminated in an incident that happened on February 8th, 1968. So it's about a month before the My Lai massacre. His unit, they went into a small hamlet, and the commanding officer, a captain, a West Point train captain, ordered all the civilians there to be rounded up. And he did. The civilians were rounded up, and then he issued an order to kill anything that moves. And Jamie was taking a break. He was smoking a cigarette, and he heard this over the radio. And he got up, and he made his way towards the captain. He wanted to intervene. But he showed up just seconds late, just in time to see five men open up on full automatic with their M16 rifles and gun down the 20 or so women and children who were there. So Jamie watched this happen, and he said that 30 seconds after the massacre, he vowed to blow the whistle on it. So, you know, he came home from the war, and he went and reported it to an Army lawyer who told him to keep quiet because he said there were a million ways that the Army could make him disappear. He went and saw an Army criminal investigator, but that man threatened him. He wrote letters to two congressmen, but neither of them got back to him. So then he spoke out. He joined with other anti-war veterans at public forums. He published an article. He held a press conference. But he just couldn't get any kind of traction, and eventually he just gave up. And it was only after that I called him, and then I showed up on his doorstep with these phone book-sized stacks of records, that he knew that the Army actually conducted a thorough investigation and corroborated everything he'd said. But that, of course, was kept secret from him, kept secret from the American public, and for 40 years, and no one really knew about this massacre.
Mm. That's a sad story, because that happened a lot. I know there's lots of guys who wanted to say something, but they were afraid to, because they would have got fragged or they would have gotten shot by their own guys. And that reminds me of a guy I met, Nick, here in Oregon. His girlfriend was working at this restaurant out in Scappoose, St. Helens area. And I ran into him out there, and we were talking, and it got around to we'd both been in Vietnam. And I said, I'd 68, and he said he was there in 70. And he was talking about, he said, I was a medic. And then he pulled up his shirt, and he had a scar that went from the top of his chest down to his waist, and it went out farther. He said it goes farther. And I says, man, what happened? A rocket, mortar? And he says, no. My friends did it to me in Vietnam. And I said, what happened? And he said that he was a medic. And he said they had captured a wounded Viet Cong. And he said that they talked me into putting an air bubble in him. And the air bubble went in, you know, and it killed him. And he said then they started being afraid that I was going to talk to the captain and all these people about it. And they warned him. They said, you know, don't do it. And then he said finally that one day they just threw a hand grenade at him and just hit him and just tore him up. And they got him out of he got out of the country. I'm sure it was horrible. It was horrible, the poor guy. But that happened a lot. Nick, there was certain guys in units that you stayed away from. I mean, these guys, you could look at them and you knew they were just stone cold killers, and you just didn't even be around them. They something about them, you know, they were gone, and you just stayed away from them. One of the guys, my cousin, was a medic for an AmeriCal division. He was a combat medic, and he was saying that one guy had left Vietnam, came back, and got in his unit where he was the medic, and he said the guy went to a graveyard and dug up a grave and took the head out. He said he put it in a sack, and he says anytime they got into a battle, he would throw it, you know, thinking it would scare them.
Yeah.
You know, body parts. They were afraid of that.
Right.
And he said it was the craziest thing he ever saw. And so it went on through the whole war, Nick. I mean, the longer we were there, the less respect we had for the Vietnamese people, and it was a lot easier to do it. So to get back, I want to finish on Jamie. Whatever happened to Jamie?
Well, I was lucky enough to... to meet Jamie, and when I was working for as a freelancer for the Los Angeles Times, we were able to put Jamie's story on the front page of the paper, and you know, finally expose everything that he tried to do decades earlier, and Jamie was very proud of that. But I'm sorry to say that Jamie passed away. It's now it's going on 3 years. He was hit with three or four Agent Orange cancers all at once, just kind of came out of nowhere. And from the time he was diagnosed to the time he died, it was only, maybe about 8-10 months. That was it.
Boy, he sure did a great job by letting know what happened, buddy. He did a great service by bringing this out.
Yeah, I Jamie had told me, he had a little trepidation about... about starting it up again and going out there and talking about it after all these years. But he said to me, if it was right to do then it's the right thing now. And he always felt that it was his duty to speak up for these people who had no advocate. So he was willing to go the distance with it. And I'll always be grateful to him.
Oh man, he was a medic, and that's what medics did. They took care of people, except for that one guy. I want to talk of the Operation Speedy Express is so horrible. I mean, this just shows how high this went. And could you talk a little bit about that and where it was and this whole horrid story about the. Operation Speedy Express. It's horrible.
Yeah, Speedy Express was an operation that was carried out in the Mekong Delta, the deep south of Vietnam. And this is the rice basket of the country in a very densely populated area. And this was an operation that ran from December 1968 through the end of May 1969. And the architect of it was the commander of the 9th Infantry Division, a man named Julian Ewell, who at the time was a two-star general. He eventually became a three-star lieutenant general. And Ewell was, he had been a World War II hero, and then he kind of sat in desk duty afterwards at the White House and at the Pentagon. So when he got his combat command in Vietnam, he decided to make the most of it. And he was put into the Delta at a time when the peace talks in Paris were just starting up again. So there was a fear on some level, as far as the U.S. went, that that peace might actually break out. And before that happened, they wanted to get this critically important area, the Mekong Delta, under the firm control of their South Vietnamese allies. So Ewell was allowed to, conduct a heavy firepower war in this densely populated area. And at the end of this operation, they had an enemy body count of nearly 11,000, but they only had 748 weapons to show for it.
Mm.
So it was apparent that while people were getting killed in the Delta, it didn't seem that they were armed guerrillas. And there was a whistleblower within the unit who wrote letters to General Westmoreland, who I mentioned earlier, and a couple other top-ranking American generals to say what he had seen gone on there. And the way he put it was that it was like a mean lie a month in the Delta. And he said that that Ewell's policies allowed the countryside to really be opened up to unrestrained fire, that they called in artillery on villages, that anyone seen running was shot and called in as a guerrilla taking evasive action. And the military knew about this, but they sat on it. They eventually identified the whistleblower because he was anonymous, but they tracked down who he was. And right after they did, the records go silent. He never wrote the military anymore. The records don't say what happened to him. And when it came time for me to try and track him down, unfortunately, he'd passed away. So we'll never know exactly what happened with him. But Newsweek magazine, they discovered this story a couple years after Speedy Express, and they dug into it rather deeply, and they determined that as many as 5,000 civilians were killed during this operation, and the military, they claimed that they didn't know anything about it, and they had no information on this, even though there was this whistleblower. And the military conducted its own investigation of Speedy Express to figure out what really did happen down there. And they determined that Newsweek's estimate was a low-end one. The military's own internal investigation of Speedy Express suggests that somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 civilians were killed during the operation. So more than half of the body count was civilians.
Mm. My gosh, that's just horrible. Whatever happened to this general?
Yes, Julian Ewell got his third star after Speedy Express ended, and he was promoted to command a two field force in Vietnam, which was the largest U.S. combat command in the world at the time. And then from there, he was sent to Paris to join the Paris peace talks as the military's official attaché. So this sent him on an upward trajectory.
Mm-hmm. I would let, we're going to be running out of time soon, but I want to ask you, when you were writing this book, Killing Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, what struck you the most? What really got you the most that you just couldn't believe that would happen, that would happen?
Well, I mean, there were so many individual incidents that were shocking to me and horrifying, but the thing that really struck me was, the first time I went to Vietnam, I went with these documents in hand, and I went to try and find witnesses and survivors to individual cases. I'd roll into the village, and I'd start talking to people, and I'd be asking them questions about this one spasm of violence, say, one massacre. But what they would talk to me about was what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and shells and helicopter gunships, and how they had to negotiate their entire lives around the U.S. war machine, how every day there were calculations to be made, when to come out of the bomb shelter to forage for food or to farm at night or to get water or relieve oneself. And the stories that they told me of just the day-to-day of the war and how they had to live with this, that's what really hit me. I realized that even though I'd studied these records, I really even I didn't have a real idea of what the war was to the Vietnamese people. And once I did, I realized that was the story that I wanted to tell. And that's why I made civilian suffering really the focus of the book, because I felt that while I'd read hundreds of books on the war, that this was never front and center in the way that the Vietnamese told me. So I think if anything, that was the thing that really struck me.
Yeah, I think that the American people have no idea the suffering that the Vietnamese went through during those 10 long bloody years of American occupation and war against the people of Vietnam. Nick, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about your book, The Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. And I hope that people will read your book and really see what war is all about. And I hope that they'll go and read some of your other articles that you've written. And you've done a great service by putting this book out, Nick. And anytime you have something that you want to talk about, you can give us a call and we'll help you get the word out on any project you're doing, buddy. And again, thanks a million, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciated the opportunity to talk to you.
It's our pleasure. Take care, Nick.
Take care, Nick, buddy. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. We'll be back on February 15th at 9 a.m., and I hope that this show has been an eye-opener for people to understand what war is really about and what we've been talking about war for the last 20 years on this radio station. And there it is.
At the end of the early British wars, the young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant, United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I
KBOO Portland, where it's time for Air Cascadia with Chris Andre.
Hey, Today is Friday, February 15th, 2013, and you are listening to KBOO, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the net. So, this morning, there are a number of events coming up. Protest marches, lectures, marking the 10 years after Iraq, where the U.S. managed to disgrace itself by disrupting a very ancient culture simply to go after a madman who was set to self-destruct and suing for peace. Anyway, Rhys Ehrlich joins us this morning. He will be talking about, Eugene, and then I believe it's tomorrow night, yes, here in Portland, the uprisings in Southwest Asia and North Africa in the context of this 10-year anniversary of shame. And Reem Khalifa is back. Loyal listeners will know that Reem was on 2 years ago in March when the uprising in Bahrain had first set off, triggered, of course, by similar freedom movements in Tunisia and all across North Africa. Bahrain, though, has a special case as a client state. And after that interview 2 years ago, she was not able to speak with us. We're very glad she's safe. She's joining us by phone from Manama, the capital of beleaguered Bahrain, to talk about the surge of unrest on the second anniversary of the uprising. First, this briefly from the National Weather Service. Day starts out with a blanket of fog in some places, otherwise mostly sunny, with a high around 59. Partly cloudy overnight, lows around 39. Chance of showers tomorrow with a high near 51. And Saturday night, it looks to be mostly cloudy, lows around 38. A nice day on Sunday, highs near 50, and Sunday night, overcast skies, lows around 35, bringing us full circle to Monday morning. We are going to forego the alternative forecast today because we have Rhys Ehrlich on the line right now. Rhys is just, I believe it's in Eugene today. It'll be in Portland on the 16th tomorrow. And if you have, many listeners have read his books and have attended the lectures, and